Welcome to our podcast. It's funny because it's true. This is Alex McQueen.
This is Timothy Clyde.
And we're going to be trying to unpick what it is that makes stuff funny. What the DNA of comedy.
The yolk. What's at the heart of the egg?
Yeah. So we've got a load of interesting guests we're going to meet. Directors, producers, writers.
Editors.
Yep.
Performers.
Stand-ups.
Horse.
But today, we've got a very, very fine guest who's famous in front of the camera as well as behind it. The very, very famous and wonderful
Matthew Richard.
Thank you very much.
Is it Lucas or is it Matthew? Is it Richard Lucas?
So the full name.
Middle piece. What's the middle?
Yeah, Matthew Richard Lucas.
Nice. Well, let us start. How the hell do we know each other?
We did Wind in the Willows.
Was it Wind in the Willows?
Yeah.
We just met on set.
We met on set in Wind in the Willows, and we were in Bucharest. And I was playing Mr. Toad, so I'd been there for a while.
Because I played the court clerk. I sentenced you to prison.
You sentenced me to prison, but I was just struck by how brilliant you were, and I just thought, yeah. And I just thought, oh, this guy's good. This guy's you were on it because you had some chunky dialogue.
I did.
And you were on it. You knew it all.
That's very good.
And you were I was just like, yeah. Whereas me. I'd just be like, what line do I do? Can we, what? I was scatterbrained.
What was the first thing that ever made you laugh? Can you recall that?
Yeah, I wrote a joke
when
I was 3 and a half, which I used to tell everybody. And it has all the rhythms of a joke without the...
punchline?
Yeah, without the rewards.
Okay.
Which is, why did the car go into the water? Why did the car drive into the water? Because it wanted to get itself wet. And I wrote that when I was 3 and a half. I remember I would tell it to everyone. I would roar with laughter.
Can I just ask, why is that funny?
Well, it's not.
Okay, there's no joke. I'm not missing something.
You know a joke has like a punchline, as a hidden second. There's no second. That's just an explanation.
It missed the back bit.
Yeah, it's the rhythms of the joke. But then, you see, it was a sort of... my version of why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side?
Yes. 3 and a half, you wrote your first...
Good joke, that.
Great.
Good joke, yeah. And then my first proper joke that I wrote.
Right.
Like when you just sort of... is an actual sort of...
joke.
Yeah, I think probably was... there's two that I can remember. So I lost my hair when I was 6 to alopecia. All my hair fell out. And...
that happened... in an instant.
It happened over just a few weeks.
Oh, really? So it's dramatic in its effect.
Yeah. Okay. And then it grew back, started to grow back and then fell out again a year later. So, and people, you know, and suddenly, it's sort of in an age before empathy, and an age where children and adults were both kind of cruel. Not shy of asking questions, pointing, laughing, all that kind of stuff. So I had to develop a sort of thick skin.
Very interesting, yeah.
There was a popular figure called Duncan Goodhue, who you'll both remember was an Olympic swimmer, who also had alopecia. And it was seen as a great a bonus for him because it was more aerodynamic through the water. But he often spoke on television and radio. People asked him, how did you lose your hair? He used to say, I was climbing and I fell out of a tree. And I think it was the shock. And I used to say, Duncan Goodhue fell out of a tree, said the shock, made his hair fall out. Yeah. Well, it was my fucking head he landed on.
Got it.
And the shock made my hair fall. So I used to say that when I was about 10 or 11. I remember thinking that's quite funny.
Yeah.
But people didn't really laugh, but people were just like, huh? Adults would laugh, kids wouldn't really get it. They'd sort of take it literally. But the first joke I remember coming up with was a joke that other people have done, because I think it's one of those jokes that I can't be the only person who's written this joke, but I did write it, which was when someone, you know, talks about astrology, you know, having a conversation and they say, you know, star signs. I always say, okay, I don't really believe in star signs, but that's me, typical Pisces. So I remember writing that when I was about 14 and we've been quite happy with that. Yeah. I think Joe Brand has told the sort of same joke, we just independently came up with it, you know. We didn't see each other do the joke, we're just one of those things. But
who famous made you? I mean, who when you were growing up, well, you were already the centre of comedy. Who were you inspired by? Who
I was definitely Laurel and Hardy.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They're like your friends. But there is something eerie about those films as well. There is a real jeopardy about them. People get very angry with them. Oliver gets angry with Stan. Yeah. You know, there's things get really damaged. There's floods. There's
what violent?
They are violent. Yeah, and there's something. They're safe, but there's always a sense of danger about those films. You know that if Stanley says the wrong thing, his wife will clobber him or punish him. Oliver Hardy can, you know, will box Stan's ears if something goes wrong.
It's quite Punch and Judy.
Yeah, it is quite. Yeah. They'll throw a brick at someone's head or something like that. And but I still, they're still my favourites.
So Laurel and Hardy, would you describe it as one of your key inspirations?
Definitely, and Chaplin. I read his autobiography. I got his autobiography out of the school library, which is called, weirdly, My Autobiography, which is a weird title because you think, well, who else's autobiography could it be? Because an autobiography is, by definition, the writer's. But anyway, and I read both parts of that, and I became a real Chaplin aficionado, absolute Chaplin geek. There's a brilliant surrealism that's often overlooked in things like The Gold Rush, when he's doing the little routine with the bread rolls. And I think there's a sense that Laurel and Hardy, and I don't mean this in a bad way, was slightly churning it out. They weren't really seen as artists, Laurel and Hardy. They were just sort of funny.
Turns.
Yeah, they were turns. It's almost like you would watch their films like you'd watch a sitcom every week on TV. You'd be watching it like
Duty
that.
Duty Free or Tony and Judy.
Duty Free or You Must Be the Husband with Annette Newman. But Chaplin was sort of, I think, an artist. Now, actually, Laurel and Hardy probably makes me laugh more than Chaplin. And there's a mawkishness to Chaplin now that hasn't, a sentimentality that hasn't dated very well. But I love those things. But I also loved Morecambe and Wise and the Two Ronnies, and I used to watch those shows.
Completely.
There's a warmth about Morecambe and Wise that I think the Two Ronnies were less warm and more clever.
Yeah.
But one of the, you know, I do remember coming back from Cub Camp and being picked up and going straight to my grandmother's house. And as I walked in, I said, did you remember to video the Two Ronnies? Because it was a Sunday and it would have been on the night before. And I said that before I said hello to grandma, and I got in a lot of trouble. trouble.
So, Morecambe and Wise.
Yes.
What would you?
I mean, everyone loves
Morecambe. Yeah, but what do you think? It's very difficult to answer. But what would you say is there? What's their unique secret? You talk about the warmth there.
They are warm.
Which others maybe don't have so much. What do you think is going on there that makes us want to not stop watching them?
Well, I think they feel like, I mean, they reinvent themselves. They have motifs running through, you know, like Ernie being the aspiring writer, being the short one, being more of a Lothario, you know, maybe being mean. All those, they have various different sort of running gags. But they used to have a star guest in each show, or a couple, and they'd be laughing with the celebrity, but they'd encourage the celebrity to sort of take the mick out.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, which was really a good thing.
And the more serious the guest, the better. It's like a very prominent conductor or a very
Andre Previn or Glenda Jackson. This is it. People like that. Yeah, there's also the sense of routine about it, which is, you know, they owned Christmas. That's the Christmas show is Morecambe and Wise. And even, I mean, I was 9, I think, when Eric Morecambe died, 8 or 9. I remember when he died. But they carried on just repeating every Christmas, regardless.
Yeah.
There wasn't a break. They
I
just
still
every
think
Christmas.
It's probably the best thing on TV.
Yeah.
So good.
I think they're very warm. Eric Morecambe's like the funny uncle at a family do, isn't he? He's just got the tricks. He'll be able to wiggle his.
Well, he's naughty
for 50, he's, or however he was.
Yeah, he's naughty, but it's actually never lecherous. I mean, is that the age of the Carry On movies? Is the same era, and I love the Carry Ons. Yeah. But there's nothing sexual about Morecambe and Wise, is there?
No.
And I used to love that they shared the bed together, though. Yeah. I thought it was really sweet. They're like brothers, you know.
Yeah.
They're very charming. And
it's innocent, wasn't it? It's beautifully innocent.
Innocent. Also playing a lot with that thing that in the 80s and 70s and 80s was so prevalent in comedy double acts that you don't really see anymore. It's not really a thing anymore. But growing up, which is, you know, you'd have Ernie in the foreground trying to, quotes, do something serious, and then Eric in the background ruining it.
Yeah.
And Cannon and Ball always did that thing, didn't they?
Well,
and Little and Large did that thing. And it's the thing, isn't
it? To a degree, but they wrote some Two Ronnies.
But I don't think the Two Ronnies did that.
Consistently.
No, I think Smith and Jones did a little bit of it, but it's the idea of the more serious member of the act.
Being thwarted.
Coming on, yes, exactly, and saying, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to now be singing I Who Have Nothing. You know, I who have nothing. And then, you know, somebody walking on just in underpants at the back going, I've almost got nothing as well. You know, it's that kind of, I've just made that up, but yeah, it's the sort of thing you would have seen, wouldn't you? You'd see Eric Morecambe walking on in a sort of overcoat, sweeping up in the background while Ernie was trying
utterly undermining and thwarting.
Yeah. And Cannon and Ball did all of that as well in Little and Large and
so if they're your influences or they had an impact...
Well, there's the big influence I haven't mentioned.
Right, well, let's do that.
Yeah. Is Vic and Bob.
Right.
Yeah. And they were, if I had to pick one, I mean, I loved Harry Enfield as well. I was a huge Harry Enfield fan, Spitting Image, Smith and Jones. I really devoured comedy. I liked Helen Pace as well.
Loved Helen.
Yeah, they don't get a lot of credit, but they did some brilliant comedy songs. They were great. But I think Reeves and Mortimer were just like aliens.
Yeah.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it must have been like, if I'd been 20 years younger and discovered the Mighty Boosh, it would have been the same thing. Which was with Reeves and Mortimer, you're in a gang.
Yeah.
If you watch their thing, you're either in the gang or out the gang.
You get that.
And it was very much like that. And just peculiarly British. And the heritage of Python and the Goons and Hoffnung and stuff like that. But
who?
Oh, Gerard Hoffnung.
Oh, right.
Oh, Gerard Hoffnung. Do you know?
No, I don't know who they are.
We're in with a treat.
Oh, really?
Gerard Hoffnung is another huge influence. Okay. Gerard Hoffnung was a humorist and a classical musician, really, and an amazing, amazing cartoonist.
Oh, great.
And he died very young. He was an immigrant from, I think, Germany.
He was a young 30?
Yes, in his 30s.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And was operating in the 40s and 50s and then gone. So sad. And anybody who's watching this, try and find Gerard Hoffnung conversations that he had. Gerard Hoffnung in conversation, these improvised.
Oh, great.
You will love that. These improvised dialogues with an American guy. Hoffnung is this old sort of chap like that. And the weird thing is, I had this character called Sir Bernard Chumley.
Yeah.
And I thought of Sir Bernard before I'd heard of Hoffnung. And I was performing Sir Bernard before I encountered Hoffnung. But when I encountered Hoffnung, I was like, oh, well, this is the same thing, but a lot better. So Hoffnung, but Vic and Bob, they were so surreal and unapologetic and exotic and strange.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was that. I loved all of that stuff.
Well, we're going to move on shortly to the process, etc. But before we do that, the Vic and Bob thing is quite a useful segue into how did you? What was your first entree?
I'll have a biscuit.
You have a biscuit time. What was your first entree?
I can see you
into comedy. How did you get into it? What was your lucky moment or break or?
Well, like a school play or actually sort of doing it professionally?
I would say professionally, yeah. How did you get into it professionally?
I haven't got a saucer or a plate.
You put it on there, that'll be fine. Yeah.
I started, I saw an advert in a magazine to go on a stand-up comedy course. I wanted to do stand-up comedy in my year off.
What?
I'd been in the National Youth Theatre where I'd met David Walliams, who people don't really know who he is anymore, but he was a comic writer and actor of this sort of early noughties.
Yeah.
And
the tall one in Little Britain is that
what we're
talking about? Yeah. The other guy.
He gave it up years ago, but he had a moment.
Yeah.
And I was in the National Youth Theatre where I met him. We were introduced to each other. He's 3 years older than me, and he was already in a play. I was on the introductory sort of...
course.
The course, yeah. It was in the Halls of Residence.
Tufnell Park.
In Huddleston Road, in Tufnell Park, University Halls of Residence, which the National Youth Theatre used during the summer holidays to base their actors who were on courses or actually in the plays. Because with the National Youth Theatre, you'd have to be on a course in your first year that was 2 or 3 weeks, and then you'd be eligible to audition for a part in a play. David was in a play called Surrender Dorothy in the summer of 1990 that I think went to the Edinburgh Festival. And but they were rehearsing in London. They may have had a short run in London as well, I'm not sure. But they were doing some rehearsals in London. And I was on the junior course because I was 16. So I was one of the youngest members. And I used to do an impression, which I won't do, of Jimmy Savile.
Okay.
And David, I
was about to make you do it, but no.
Let's not do that. And David did a much better impression of Frankie Howard. Of course, he ended up playing Frankie Howard in a drama.
Oh, did he?
On BBC Four, yeah. And I used to do my impression. People just used to call me Jimmy. People thought that was my name, and they thought his name was Frankie. They just called him Frankie.
Okay, so first of all, you were known as Jimmy and Frankie.
And right. People kept telling me, have you met the guy who does Frankie Howard? Have you met the guy? He's so funny. So I just heard about him. And then in the bar at the Halls of Residence, where the snooker table was, and the bar and the jukebox, it used to play Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones. In that room, I remember, by the snooker table, we were introduced to each other.
Who introduced you?
It was a guy actually called Jimmy, who was a Geordie, who was there on one of the courses.
He had no idea what he was doing.
And he that's extraordinary. That's my memory of it. Yeah. He kept saying, you got to meet Frankie. He's so funny, like that. And
when you did meet him,
God. Well, he towered over me because I'm 5'6½". He's 6'3", so he towered over me. And of course, when you're 16 and someone's 19,
it's a massive difference.
They might as well be 50 years old.
Yeah.
And he had a confidence and an authority. And I just thought he was, the impression was amazing. And every time I saw him, I said, go on, do it. And he'd be very annoyed that I was sort of making him do it, but then he'd...
Kind of like it, yeah.
But in the end, sometimes he'd go, no, and other times he'd go, all right.
Well, I think we should put that down as that's the moment where your professional career really began. That's so we can now, I think we can, yeah, we can
but
probably...
How did you meet the Frog and well,
so,
Stars?
So the next year, the next summer, when I was 17, in the summer of 1991, the National Youth Theatre did a production of The Tempest. And David was in it as Stefano or Trinculo, I can't remember which one. And he was hilarious. And I was bringing props on and off stage. But it was a really weird, it was done in a Japanese style. So we were called Koken. So we were covered head to toe in black with black masks. And the set was sort of, the props were fluorescent and they had the ultraviolet light. And then we would move the props like this and would do the Sorcerer's Apprentice and things like that. So I would watch David in rehearsals every day, and we swapped addresses at the end, and we stayed in touch. And I used to go and watch him do stand-up comedy. And he was in a double act with a guy called Jason Bradbury, who used to host The Gadget Show on Channel 5 quite recently. And quite recently. And I used to go and watch them.
Where?
They used to do open spots in the London circuit. I used to watch them at the Comedy Store.
Right, okay.
And they'd often they were sort of Vic and Bob light, basically. But they had some really great lines. But I quoted some the other day and David was not happy about it because he's very embarrassed. But I used to think they were really hilarious. And I'd go and watch them and sometimes they'd die a day.
Okay.
But I would be in split in my sides. Yeah, I was just remember thinking it was the funniest thing in the world. Even though I'd see him sometimes just absolute tank. Sometimes I'd see them do really well, but Jason didn't really want to be in a double act that much. So, but I was really inspired by them, and that was the bridge to me knowing some people that actually performed, because I used to go to comedy clubs and watch people. I used to go to a comedy club called Punchlines, which was in West Hampstead, and I'd go and see everyone there, Harry Hill and Alan Davis and Joe Brand. And this is in like 1991, 1992. And I was 18 years old, and I used to go with friends and I'd be first in the queue, and I absolutely love it. Mark Thomas and Kevin Day and Kevin Eldon, and see really great comedians. And then I decided to do it myself. So I saw an advert in a magazine, and I went on a stand-up comedy course that was run by a comedian called Ivor Dembina. And it was like a night school for about 6 or 8 weeks.
Once a week,
Thursday nights in 1992. And I said to my mum, I really want to I want to take a year off before going to university after A-levels and do stand-up. My mum said, well, you have to get a job. I mean, I can't. Yeah, it was just me and my mum. I can't afford to just have you living here. So I got a job working in the day at Chelsea Football Club in the club shop. I'm a big Arsenal fan. But I used to help run youth clubs at the local synagogue and our family synagogue in Northwest London. And I used to sometimes babysit for some of those kids that used to come to youth club. And one family, I used to babysit for them regularly. And he had the franchise to run the shop at Chelsea Football Club. So I went to work for him full time. Their surname was Pollard, which of course ended up Vicky Pollard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I started doing stand up at the age of 18 after Ivor Dembina's comedy course.
And that's when Vic and Bob came to see you. And that's when they went, we'll have you.
I've been doing it for open spots for 5 weeks. I mean, really.
Quite novice.
Very, very novice. I don't know what my act was, but I went to play the White Horse in Belsize Park. There was a small comedy club below it called the VD Clinic, which was short for the Valdunican Clinic. And it was for new acts.
Right.
And so I'd done a couple of shows there. And when I say shows, like a sort of 10-minute routine that I'd written as this character, Sir Bernard Chumley, who ended up in Little Britain.
I remember it.
Yeah.
I remember him being at the Edinburgh Festival and hearing about it. You used to heckle yourself. Shut up, what?
Yeah.
I thought, oh, you genius, you bastard. How dare you be so good?
Yeah.
Sorry.
One of my favourite heckle put-downs, which I did later on, which was somebody heckled me and I don't know what I did it, but I just went, look, I'm really trying my best up here. This is actually extremely hurtful. That, you know, I'm giving my best. I'm trying to tell jokes. And you're just sort of shouting at me. And think about what that does to me. And then I just went back into the room. Which is such a weird thing to do. But I remember there was that delay, and then it got a big roar of laughter because I'd been heckling myself nonstop.
Right.
And then just suddenly just did that.
Got it.
And then went back into heckling.
So, but also, it's basically no one else can play this game. I can, you can't.
Yeah, exactly. So I was at performing at the White Horse, and I saw Bob Mortimer in the bar before the show, and I was like,
bloody
oh my God,
hell.
Because I was a Reeves and Mortimer fanatic. And they kind of influenced the act I was doing. It was very sub Reeves and Mortimer what I was doing. And I went and just very briefly introduced myself, but.
So you took the initiative to go up and
Really like, oh, are you a veteran the show tonight? He went, yeah, yeah. I went, okay, I'm performing. He went, oh cool. And that was it. Like, there was no other. I'm just a really big fan. Okay, thank you. And I don't think it necessarily registered because probably everywhere he went that happened.
People were, yeah.
His friend was a man called Dorian Crook.
I love Dorian Crook.
Yeah.
He's an air traffic controller.
Yeah.
Is he? I think he may have stopped now, but he's a great guy. Marvellous human. Come on, Simon.
You met at my birthday.
I did, yeah.
I'm still friendly with Dorian. Dorian was comparing that night. And so Bob had been at art school with Dorian had been at art school with Vic Reeves. And Dorian had become a friend of Bob's and had actually performed in their Big Night Out shows. And Bob was in the audience. And while I was performing, my memory is of Bob coming closer to the front and while I was on stage. That's my memory of it. And then after the show, and it went down really well. I stormed in.
It was Chumley.
Bernard, yeah. And I was like, Bob Morton is in the audience.
I
don't know if I'm going to go. I don't know if anyone's going to laugh, but I need to
make this work.
I need to make this work because this is shit just got real. Yeah. You know what I mean? This is a whole other thing. I'm 18 years old. I'm working in a job I'm really, it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And I'd had a tough life and I started doing stand-up and my hero is in the audience and I'm 18 and I've been doing this for 5 weeks. And it hasn't been going that well. And so I go on stage and somehow they all laugh. And Bob really laughs. And I'm looking at him and he's really laughing.
Great.
And then afterwards comes up to me in the pub upstairs above and introduces himself. So I don't think he remembered that I'd met him before the gig. Because I'd sort of ambushed him. No. Okay. Also, I think I'd had the wig on and now I didn't have the wig on. Right. So I used to wear a wig. So I think maybe it just hadn't quite registered.
This is the character.
Yeah, he introduced, the character. And he introduced, because I lost my hair when I was 6. I actually had a wig at school and it's that wig I used to wear.
Oh, I see. So you, right.
So it wasn't a character wig. This was actually.
Well, it wasn't, no. It was
at this point, it was.
By this point, it was a character wig.
But even previously.
Because I'd go on stage and it was the biggest laugh I'd get, which is to sometimes just be on stage and like with 3 minutes to go, I just do that and carry on. And all the hair would just go and I just carry on.
You did that in Amphibious Spangulals.
Probably.
Because it gave people a bit of a shock. Did I do that in Amphibious? Because I now remember.
Right, well.
You've saved that to the end because you did. You sort of, it was
just
very
did that
good.
And then just carried on.
Carried on as if nothing.
Nothing, yeah. So I do that. Or sometimes I go, and then put it back on. I mean, depending on what I fancied. Or sometimes heckle me, oh, shut up. I throw it and just carry on, yeah. And he said, I really enjoyed what you did. He said, I work at a company called Channel X and I'd love to help you get seen and help you get some work. So he didn't say I'm a comedian. He just said I work with a company called Channel X. And it was very... And I gave him my phone number. And I couldn't believe
it. It was a landline, I presume.
Yeah, it was a landline. And then he called me. Yeah,
brilliant.
About 3 weeks later.
What does 9 to 5 at Sir Matthew Lucas's look like when you're building?
If I was working with Walliams?
Yeah.
I was working on my own.
Let's start with Walliams. When you're working as a duo, and then maybe when you're on your own, that'd be very interesting to compare and contrast. But what would a day look like? We've got another episode of Little Britain to write. Where the hell do you start?
Well, we used to write Little Britain or Come Fly With Me at his house or mine. Obviously, his flat or mine at the same. Yeah. And then as we did well, his house or mine. And then eventually, I go there. Sometimes it might be a member of staff over the door.
I'm not joking.
We were pretty good. We would aim to start 10. I would always arrive at 10:04 because I can't seem to get mine.
Really? Okay. So right.
Yeah. Or 10:06 or something.
Close to 10.
Maybe on a really good day, 9:59.
If he owes people money, let's say it's £5, he'll always send £4.99. Yep. Like a penny off.
Yep.
Just to tease people. Yeah, anyway. Go on. So you get there, you wouldn't get there on time.
But not terribly.
Not deliberate.
I'd always be a little bit. And we'd chat. Just what did you see last night? Which TV show did you watch? Did you went to the theatre or you saw a film or you saw a friend? Yeah. But 10 minutes.
Okay.
8 minutes.
Not an hour.
No, I'd like to.
You would have. Say, I would have done 2 hours.
Yeah.
But he's more.
Yeah. I wrote a thing with Reese Thomas once.
Yeah.
Do you know Reese?
Yeah, I do.
Who I'm very, very fond of. And I mean, I think we wrote a line a day because we were just having too much fun just chatting. But no, we were pretty good. And then he's very disciplined. And then we work until, you know, 1 o'clock, and then half an hour for lunch. But often working over, you know, still talking about the work during lunch, and then working till 4:30-ish, I would say. So 10 to 4:30, yeah, which is a short working day. But then you've got to go home and do a ton of emails,
yeah,
and do other things, or sometimes have meetings as well. But we try and do 10 to 4:30, sometimes 10 to 5, at very least 6 hours of writing. And how we would write, you know, each day you try and write a sketch or two before lunch and a sketch or two after. So 2 to 3 sketches a day, I would say, sometimes 4 on a really good day.
Would you have a method to that? Like, yeah, okay, so you start with beginning, middle, and then
yeah, yeah, you do, you plot the sketch before you write the sketch, because otherwise you're just going to be writing it and there's no ending and you don't know what to do. So you'd have a, you'd talk about the idea and try and come in with an idea. And we'd have a list anyway of
that you built up perhaps on an early session.
Yeah, right, okay. But generally, oh, you know, I saw this thing last night, you know, and I was thinking, I wonder if there's something, and you talk about it, and you go, yeah. And it's usually the kernel of something that then becomes the defining characteristic, yeah, of that character, and which is disproportionate. So you'd take something really small, but that becomes their reason.
It's really interesting, yeah.
Often it's that. I mean, different characters exist in different ways because, you know, the bitty sketches where a man is still being breastfed as an adult are very different sketches to Vicky Pollard, are very different sketches to Sebastian and the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
So sketches work in different ways. But we were...
Would you say there's a defining link between all of them, or not? Not thematically, but just, is there something at the heart of each of your sketches that is, that's the engine of it?
There's got to be something in each sketch where you recognise the truth. So for us, so Little Britain had rules, for instance, which was, you know, I was a bit reticent about trying to do a sketch show, because there were, at that time, there were a lot of sketch shows.
Yeah, was it
on TV?
Yeah.
And I just thought, and there've been some really brilliant ones, you know, in the day to day, the League of Gentlemen, even things like the Two Ronnies, not the 9 o'clock news. There've been some such brilliant sketch shows that I just thought, oh, can we compete? Should we even try? But when we came up with this concept of Little Britain, which had rules like, look, it's a look at Britain today. So, having the rules like no character is aware of the camera, so there's nothing that's done down the lens. You know, you'd go and see a sketch show and they'd go into monologues.
Got it, okay.
And you would never see the studio audience. There's no historical parodies. There's no TV and film parodies. There's no spoof adverts. It wasn't one of those sketch shows. It was.
Did you put those down on paper?
Yeah. We had the rules. Yeah. So it was, the characters do not break the fourth wall, so they don't look at the camera. They're not suddenly breaking into song, or we weren't really playing with form too much. And to a greater extent, the characters lived in a world that had the world itself had some believability, so that if a character was being wild, so when Vicky Pollard is going into a pub and she's done a dreadful fake ID, which she's just drawn herself, yeah, as a scrawl, and she's handing it over, the barman will say, well, obviously you've drawn that. So it's not like, oh, thank you very much. Yes, of course you can have a pint. Like that. When a character was misbehaving, that there was, it was acknowledged that,
yeah,
you know, you can't just do that. The rules are the rules. And because without those rules, it can just be anything. Yeah. And then there's nothing at stake. You know, I mean, this is not a criticism of Monty Python. It's more of an observation, because Monty Python's is up there with Alice in Wonderland. It's up there with, you know, the Edward Lear. I mean, it's that tradition, rich tradition of surreal, brilliant surreal art, isn't it? But they'll do things at the end of their sketches, which was maverick and groundbreaking in its day. Was, I think we've had enough of this sketch. I think I'm going to go and take a walk in the ocean or something like that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And then walk out into another sketch, which is amazing. And I loved it, but we weren't allowed to do things like that in our show. We absolutely no. And generally, it was interesting because Little Britain began on radio, and we did some sketches which I really loved on radio, that never could have existed in the TV show for that reason, and also because they would have been far too expensive to film. Which was, we did these sketches. I think they may have even been in the very first ever episode where we, it was the witch from Hansel and Gretel having her house built. So Ueg looked like a contractor and he's just giving her an appraisal, say, yeah, I wouldn't advise for the toffee roof, love, because that's going to melt in, that'll melt in summer. I'm trying to get you, glacier mints for the windows, obviously. I'm trying to get you, you know, it was
now, where
all
did that come from?
Well, it was just like,
was that just the accident of you?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Being playful in
it
your
might
mind.
Have been David's idea.
Well, yeah,
it was, but it was just a what if, you know, what if the witch was,
yeah, that's
genuinely
a great,
trying
that's a really
to
good device.
Have that house built. Like, if you were trying to build a house made out of sweets, it would just,
yeah,
it would sort of melt, it would crumble, the biscuits would go stale. I mean, it just wouldn't. No one's really given it much thought.
It was a very useful device, that. What if?
Yeah, what if? So it was a funny sketch, and she's like, oh, yeah, like the toffee roof, that'll give you a jip in the summer. And I'm just worried about this and that. And it's quite a sweet, you know. Yeah, what I've done is, and you could sort of hear the sounds of the building site, I think. And it was a fun sketch. And so just one thing, why are you making a house out of sweets? And she just says, oh, to lure children here and kill them. And then that's just the end of the sketch.
Routine.
Yeah, totally routine, as if like,
no, of course. Blase.
Yeah, and I loved that sketch. I was really proud of it. And I really campaigned to have it in the TV pilot. And of course, people said, well, it's gonna cost you £30,000 or £40,000 to build that house. So we can't, you know, we can't afford to do that. And I was like, oh, maybe in the series. But actually, of course, when I tell you that sketch now, you go, well, that sketch wouldn't go in Little Britain because it's set in a fairyland and Little Britain isn't.
Yeah.
I think probably one of the few concessions where we just said, you know what, we really like it, we're going to do it, is the Dennis Waterman sketches where he's tiny.
Okay.
And we play.
Yes, because that is fantastical.
That is fantastical. Yeah. And we don't have very many. But I think, you know, if you look at, like, often you're favorite American comedies, particularly that they were doing in the sort of 80s and 90s, where it's like big, you know, where you have a sort of realish world, but one rule can be broken, you know, and if you keep breaking lots of rules, it's just a mess. But in big, it's like, oh, they've, you know, he's a 12-year-old in the body of an adult. Little Britain, we tried not to break
those,
that rule. I think Dennis Waterman was probably the rule you can break.
Yeah.
But just generally, we tried to stick to those rules. And we had Tom Baker's narration, which was really useful because it meant we could start a sketch at the last minute possible.
Yes.
And we didn't have to have loads of exposition and explanatory
explaining
stuff in the sketch.
Right.
Is it right, Dev? Because he can tell you and make you laugh at the same time everything you need to know so that you can just get on with the business
of
the sketch.
That's great.
It was a good idea. And that only came because it was on radio.
Right.
You know, and we needed to do something on radio.
And then it worked.
Yeah, and then when we were talking about doing the TV pilot, there was like, well, we don't need it for TV. Maybe we shouldn't have it. But then we're like, that's really funny.
And it's really useful.
And it's really useful. Really? But originally we were talking, well, maybe we don't, because you can see it.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm really glad we kept it.
Yeah. We were talking, trying to understand, one of the obvious things with being funny is being close to a line or being, you know, how far. Watching, and I love Little Britain so much, but I thought one thing you did so brilliantly was kind of kiss the line. But it felt like, and the beauty of it was all your characters sort of were really close to being, can you get away with that?
Yeah. You know why? Because people like that stuff. Yeah, they're like watching that stuff. It's a bit of a myth at the moment that people don't like watching that stuff. They actually enjoy it. They love being offended. And that's why the show did well.
Comedy has to be unkind, unpleasant, yeah. Naughty, rude.
Yeah, because it has to speak the truth. Yeah. And, you know, if you go back to, you know, medieval times, with the jester was the only one who could say those things about the king. Nobody else could. They'd lose their heads. But the jester could. And you need a jester. You need somebody with free rein to say, to speak.
Truth unto power and to tell people truths that they know but daren't speak.
Yeah.
But was that part of the rule book? Were you consciously doing that? Or was it just part of
We're just trying to make ourselves laugh. But of course, you know, we our first shows that we did, me and David together, were at the Edinburgh Festival. And we were on at midnight and we were playing a sweatbox of a room to an audience that might have already seen 3 or 4 shows that day. And they're already drunk and it's midnight. And so we used to have to terrorize that room ourselves. or we would get terrorized. For us, Little Britain was really reined in from what we were doing on stage. Imagine, it was a very
terrorize these people.
demure version of it. You know, no, Little Britain was very vanilla for us. I should just say another thing about the Little Britain writing process, because I would recommend this to anybody. If they were ever doing a sketch show again, and of course there's not many sketch shows on TV.
Shame. I think there's zero.
Yeah, but even if you're doing stuff for TikTok and YouTube and Insta and other platforms, we made a kind of mistake early on, or something we just learned, which is about every sort of month or 6 weeks, we try and get in a room with whoever was producing that series, because the producer was originally Mfamwi Moore, and then she was expecting twins. So Jeff Posner then produced the show from then on. And then we had a different director each time, because we picked great directors, but they were always in demand. And we actually had, again, different. We had Mark Gatiss script edit the first series, and Rob Brydon and Richard Herring. We had good people, but they're always busy, so we'd have to get new people in. But every sort of 6 weeks or so, we'd get a little office somewhere, hire a room in, sometimes it was at Soho House, because they could bring lunch and cups of tea in, which is quite useful. But we'd sit around a table and read everything we'd written so far. And after every sketch, we'd get notes about, oh, that's
who
worked.
Who would you read it to?
To Jeff.
Jeff. Oh,
and Rob Brydon, say, and Mark Gatiss, or whoever was in the room. There's only be 2 or 3 others, sometimes the director, but they might not come aboard till later. But just reading it out loud and then just talking about each sketch and going, oh, I think that'll work, or that should be good, or I don't think that's quite working. One of the things we did was, because we'd have, first series we had 8 episodes, and after that it was 6 episodes per series. We would, often try and write 6 sketches, because it's for economy of scale, which is, if you're going to spend 30 grand on a Bubbles bodysuit, you can't only do 1 sketch. You know, you have to do more. And if you're going to that location for Marjorie and hiring all those actors and setting it up, you need to have more sketches. And also, some characters, their impact grows when you see them again and you learn more about them, and and sometimes I think, oh, that character, we've seen them already, why are we seeing them again? But it's to do with, we'd get criticized for that sometimes. But it's just to do with what you can afford to do, which is, you can only justify doing that if you can get 18 minutes out of it. If you can only get 6 minutes out of it, we can't afford to do it in the series. So you have to film a number of sketches. And if you film them, you've got to use the least worst ones, so they end up in the show. But the thing I was going to say is, when we first started writing the show, we might write 6 sketches of a new character we'd be really excited about. And we'd sit in the room and read it out. And the first sketch went down all right. And the second sketch, nah. And then we'd go, oh, we don't even need to read the other ones out loud, because this character is just
a duck.
It's a dead duck, yeah. And we were pretty good, me and David, I mean, David in particular, we were pretty good going, that's not working, let's just leave it. Okay. Let's just leave it. If we just can't get it working, let's just, we don't have time.
But we just became a bit more strategic. And so by the time we were working on our second and third series, if we came up with an idea, even if we loved it, even if we were absolutely sure that you could get six or more sketches out of it, one for each episode, we still probably would only write two of them first time and read them out before we went to write the others. Even if we might write down the idea we have for that other sketch, but it was very, we stopped writing six sketches for a character.
It'd be mini-pilots.
Mini-pilots in that room
before
committing. Because that's still two or three days' work, writing those other sketches. And it's just not good use of your time.
Yeah.
You know, because we were having to also do a series every year. And that's a lot, you know, to write that and hone it down and rewrite and rewrite.
And you didn't have a writer's room. You
were doing
yourselves, basically.
It's us, yeah. I think in later series, a couple of people wrote, I think there are about six sketches that appeared in Little Britain that were written by other people that we rewrote, which were existing characters that they would come in and generate some ideas for. But I would say genuinely 99% of Little Britain was written by the two of us. Yeah.
Is there anything you've stolen from working with someone else? Something that a little technique or a little charm or ability or skill where you've gone, or someone's given you advice, you go, I'll take that.
Yeah. The other thing I learned, which I think is really good, is from Reeves and Mortimer. When I was writing comic songs for Shooting Stars, Bob said, take that song, cut it in half, and then cut it in half again. And so my songs were 45 seconds, 50 seconds, right?
That's great as an insight to how to do comedy, brilliantly.
Yeah, and Ivor Dembina, going full circle to when I was 18 and I was doing stand-up comedy, and his advice to stand-ups is great, and I'll finish with this. He says, if it's going badly, get off. If it's going well, get off.
Well, that's it for this episode. A colossal thank you to Matt Lucas. And don't forget to subscribe and like. And we'll see you next time.